Well, we continue our series on John 3:16 and the God-given commentary on John 3:16 that we've been given in verses 17 to 21. I hardly need give you the page number now again, but for those who are not historians, it's 1066. And our verse today is part of the commentary on John 3:16. It is verse 19, and the title for today is A Preference for Darkness, A Preference for Darkness. Let me read the verse. This is the verdict. Light has come into the world, but men loved darkness instead of light because their deeds were evil. This series has certainly been a blessing for me to prepare, and I hope it's been a blessing for some of you to receive. And so we continue all that we've been looking at so far, but in the shadow, of course, of Remembrance Day, when the immeasurable cost to our nation in blood and tears, the price of defending our freedom, is brought annually to our minds. And we're going to find that this verse is very relevant to that. Incidentally, the bitterness of the memories of Remembrance Day to many of the older relatives still living has been greatly exacerbated, I think, in this century by a very popular notion that these thousands of men, especially in World War I, were led as sheep to the slaughter by leaders who were donkeys. Some of you will have read the book by Alan Clark, called The Donkeys, about the generals of the First World War. So I was interested to read, as many of you will have read in the papers this weekend, of a whole school of young historians who are giving us a revisionist view of the First World War, pointing out that it really was inevitable, that Britain can be proud to have stood against very brutal tyrants, and that Haig was a good general after all and defended us against overwhelming odds. Now, however true that may be, I find it very interesting as an entirely new look on a history that happened long before any of us were around. My own suspicions are that the view that it was all a vast and tragic blunder in 1914 to 18 was an inevitable mid-20th century view, when humanistic and secular thinking was really conquering the chattering classes. When the view was that war could be avoided, that pacifism was a fashion, defense was decried, and so on. And if we are Christians, and if we are Bible readers, and indeed if we are ordinary people, I think, we ought to be a great deal wiser as the century comes to a close. We're discovering that war is normal. We're discovering that it exists in every part of the globe, and we're not able to doubt this today because of television and the range of news that reaches us. I was actually very struck in reading my new edition of Operation World. I hope you bought your fifth edition. It's a magnificent compendium of what God is doing throughout the world in missionary work. I actually relearned how many wars are going on when I was reading of many of the nations where we've even forgotten that a war is going on, and I suppose very often people are so fed up with it and TV simply turns it off because it goes on and on. So as Christians, facing up to the past helps us to face up to the present and to prepare for the future. And the future is not a rosy one for our children and the generations to come. This world is very full of tragedy. It always will be, because the king has been rejected. That's what Reed Mark learners discover as they go through that gospel. So suitably for a day like this, that is a solemn day, that isn't looking back at something in the past as it'll never happen again, but conscious very much that it will happen again in different ways that we don't yet imagine, we have a verse which is part of the tragic tone of John's gospel. It's a tragic verse, but after all, we've had so many glorious verses from John 3:16 onwards that maybe it's right to look at the dark clouds and the dark shadow as well. So let me read it again in the light of today. This is the verdict, that light has come into the world, but men love darkness instead of light because their deeds were evil. It's all part of what one great commentator has called the tragic turn in John's gospel. What we're going to do, therefore, this morning is we're going to look in detail at this verse, the three parts of it. Then at the end we'll have 2 minutes silence in which we'll stand to remember the sacrifice of many that make it possible for us to be free today. And then we'll have very brief Remembrance Day prayers. That's the order of events before we close our service. But before we go any further, let me ask you to consider our title for today, A Preference for Darkness, because it really is a mad title, isn't it? As though any of us could prefer darkness to light. I mean, I suppose when the Lord Mayor and his lady got up yesterday morning very early to don all their quaint medieval clothes, they looked out of the window and they saw the dark clouds and the rain pouring down, and they must have said, oh, I wish it had been a day like yesterday. It was such bad luck for them to have a dark day and not a sunny day. I imagine that there are some purists who will come into the new St. Andrews and say, what a pity we've got windows which let the light in and all this marvellous light. I suppose there will be people who criticise us. Somebody has already and called it theatrical. But do you want to go back to the days when you couldn't see anything in St. Andrews? When it's like a dark cavern? Does anybody want that? I suppose there are some people who love the winter drawing in. I'm just longing for February when the days lengthen again. I always open my diary first thing in the morning in January and February to see how many minutes extra I've got that day of light. At least perhaps that's because I'm peculiar. But don't you prefer the lightness to darkness? What about our dear Ronald? Some of you will have heard the rather sad news that he seems to have had another perhaps tiny little stroke in the nursing home on Thursday. And one of the difficulties is that he can't see very well at the moment as a result of this spasm or whatever it is. So that he went into the bedroom next door and announced to the frightened lady there that he was going to get into bed with her. Not seeing her or the bed or that it wasn't his room, bless his heart. Well, do pray for Ronald. These are difficult days for him and Phyllis. But wouldn't you rather see the light than not know where you're going? It's inconceivable, isn't it, that ordinary people should prefer darkness to light. And in fact, ordinary people do prefer light to darkness. We all of us, whether we're Christians or not, prefer justice to injustice, freedom to oppression, love to hatred, peace to violence. I suppose there are some warped people who don't, but all of us prefer light to darkness. How then are we to explain this extraordinary preference recorded here for our learning concerning the past and to alert us to the future that John has given us in this verse? And so I'm going to ask you to turn with it to me and to look at it with me to it and look at it in its various parts. I find it quite fascinating to do that, and I hope you will for a few minutes with me this morning. Verse 19 then, the first clause, this is the verdict, and I've called this a process. A process that is at work in all human history. Now this, although it's a lovely sounding phrase as it was read just now, is not actually a very happy translation. The proper translation is the old one, I think. This is the condemnation. This is the judgment. It's not referring to the final verdict on your life and mine that God will one day give. It's referring, actually, to a present process of condemnation that is going along every day in the world in which we live. So I'm afraid we've got to change that translation and come back to the old one. This, then, is the condemnation, and it's the present process that is being worked out. Now, this present condemnation that is going on is not the divine intention. I do hope that's clear to you. It's a thing I've relearned. God is not hovering over us with a sword. God so loved the world that he sent his only begotten Son. And verse 17 is so grandly clear, isn't it? God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world. Now, man is not confronted with God with a drawn sword. He is confronted in this universe today with the love and light of God approaching him in Jesus Christ. Every time we preach the gospel, let's bear that in mind so we don't preach it with frowns. You know, some of the old hellfire preaching, I think, was far too grim, though it is right that we should remind people of what it means to reject the light, of course. Gospel preaching is preaching of God's love, of the light coming into the world, and of the unbelievable situation that men chose darkness rather than light. Now, I ask you to notice the very strong emphasis here on human choice and deliberation. We make this decision, verse 19. Light has come into the world, but men love darkness rather than light. Let me make a contrast that you may not be aware of, but you certainly heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls. There used to be a great deal of talk about them. They seem to have disappeared. Well, most of the Dead Sea Scrolls have now been deciphered. And the teaching of the people of Qumran, the people who lived in those isolated communities, quite close, of course, to where our Lord and his disciples lived, the people of Qumran saw things quite differently from Jesus and the writers of the New Testament. In Qumran, there was a rigid and hopeless determinism. Men were divided into men of darkness and men of light. You belonged to one class or the other. You couldn't escape your fate. Your fate was absolutely sealed, and you had no power of choice. Now, God forbid that we should preach Christianity in those terms. Not so John. John is concerned with a meaningful moral choice. What are you going to choose now that light has dawned? It's not blind fate for any of us. We're not locked into darkness. We may love darkness and choose it, we may prefer it, and that is to destroy ourselves, but we are not automatons. We're not robots. We're not like a car factory robot programmed to make some decision. We mustn't misuse the wonderful truths of foreknowledge and predestination to teach this. Now, if I may use an anachronism that will make some of you smile, John the Apostle was a Calvinist. Turn a page or two over to John 6:37 for a lovely verse. Bottom of the second column, John 6:37, "All that the Father gives me will come to me, and whoever comes to me, I will never drive away." Yes, there is a prior work of God in giving us to Jesus Christ. And then there's that very famous one, you won't want to turn to it, in John 15:16. Let me read it to you. "You did not choose me, but I chose you." Yes, we might say with a smile that John was a Calvinist. But he never deprives mankind of their dignity. They are not program machines. We do not dwell in darkness so that we cannot get out of it. Indeed, as I read verse 19 of John 3, it seems to me that we can say that no one will dwell in eternal darkness and outer darkness who did not refuse light. Now, what he's saying about the past, which must surely be true also of the present, is that when light came, astonishingly, unbelievably, men chose darkness rather than light, and that this process is happening now. This is what the theologians call realized eschatology. The judgment of God obviously lies on the future. That great day of judgment, of which the Bible speaks in such awesome terms, must be at the end of time. What he's talking about here is a judgment that's being realized in the here and now. We know that's actually true, isn't it? It's true every Tuesday that Hugh was praying for. I hope you're praying for Tuesday. Yeah, the light is shining on Tuesday, but the darkness is very strong. It's happening on Sunday night. It's an awesome thought, isn't it, that when we get up to preach here, it's not just a man getting up to spout certain things. The light of God begins to shine. The love of God draws near to people, and some prefer to turn away from that light and love, and so the process of judgment begins. You know, we love to think that whenever we preach on a Sunday night or a Tuesday, the process of salvation begins. Well, so it does, thank God. But the process of judgment begins also. So reading this verse properly, what it is saying is this. This is the process. The process that began then and has been going on ever since. That light comes into the world and men love darkness rather than light. That process is a process going on all the time. A process. However, we're going a little bit too fast. What happened to start this process? And so I want you to look secondly at a proclamation, the next phrase, light has come into the world. You know, I'm always in a rush, aren't you? And I find that I gobble up the Bible rather like I gobble up my breakfast. It's a great pity we do this. The old discipline of meditation seems to have gone right out of the window because we just don't have time for it. But one of the benefits of preparing a sermon is that you have to look at a phrase over and over again and say, why is it here and what does it mean? And suddenly this will happen when you're preparing, and I hope this happens to you when you're preparing a Bible study, that a phrase explodes in your mind and heart. I was preparing, I was just rattling away, I was looking at my commentaries, I was twiddling my thumbs, I was thinking of this and that and the other, as one does, as one minds races around, and suddenly the brilliance of this phrase hit me. Light has come into the world. 6 words of limpid clarity. Let me repeat it. It's a marvelous phrase. Light has come into the world. Now what does that mean? Light is the most marvelous metaphor, I think, in John's Gospel, and it stands, as everybody knows, for 2 things. It stands first for truth. That means the world is no longer in darkness and no longer groping for a meaning to life. And even more, light stands as a metaphor in John's Gospel for goodness. God is light, and in him there is no darkness at all. No moral evil whatsoever. Not even one little tiny speck of dirt. Now, isn't that a marvelous thing? Perfect truth and perfect goodness have come into the world in the person of Jesus Christ. It's a staggering thought. And the application is superb, isn't it? Because it destroys at a stroke 2 of the most popular assumptions of our day amongst educated people. What are those assumptions? Number 1, that there are no answers to life. We don't know really what it's all about. There's no final truth. We must all, to some extent, be agnostic. Light came into the world, so that's no longer possible. We're not in darkness. We're not groping in the world, bumping our knees on furniture without any idea what's happening. And second, if it's true, well, what is the other great popular assumption amongst educated people? No moral absolutes, no right or wrong. You can't be absolutely certain. You can't say this is right and this is wrong anymore. Light has come into the world. Now you can. Both in terms of belief and behavior, relativism is destroying true Christianity in this country and destroying our culture. I hope you know that. And our culture cannot survive. It cannot be recovered. We shall simply go back to barbarism unless we believe that light has come into the world and there is such a thing as truth and there is such a thing as goodness and they are absolutes. But you can't argue with them. Now, fathers and hosts and parents, I want to suggest something to you. On Christmas Day, probably candles will be lit in your home as they are in so many homes. I want to suggest that you use this text quite simply before grace. It would be a lovely thing to do, wouldn't it, on Christmas Day, just before everybody descends on the turkey or whatever you're having, just to say, light has come into the world. Because it's such a tremendous thing to be able to say, isn't it? And even just for a moment to explain what that means, that there is such a thing as truth and there is such a thing as a moral goodness. Light has come into the world. And yet, how does our verse go on? Well, it goes on, men love darkness rather than light. They preferred to live without this truth and without this moral goodness. And so I come to my third clause and my third word, a process, a proclamation, and then a preference, which is really the theme for today. Men love darkness instead of light. Now, it is at first, isn't it, theoretically inexplicable that we should prefer darkness to light. And I was reminded of the old preacher from the Deep South. Today, I'm going to explain to you the unexplainable, he said. I'm going to define the indefinable. I'm going to ponder the imponderable, and I'm going to unscrew the unscrutable. Well, it really is inscrutable, isn't it? It really is inscrutable. How could we possibly prefer it? Well, actually, there's no mystery at all. There's no mystery at all. Here it is. And we don't have to enter into philosophy. We don't have to enter into deep theology to get the simple answer. It is so blindingly simple. Why did men love darkness instead of light? Because their deeds were evil. Now, I think we need to tread carefully there. I was talking about the depravity of the human heart on Tuesday, 2 or 3 weeks ago, and I also felt I ought to speak about the dignity of man as well. And somebody who's been coming to us for many years came up to me immediately afterwards and thanked me. Thanked me almost as though I had never said anything about the dignity of man, but often talked about the depravity of man, and I felt rebuked. I used then, and I use now, this illustration to make plain why it is so important to emphasize the dignity of man. I use the illustration of the prodigal son in the pigsty. Now, my friends, it's quite obvious, isn't it, that if the prodigal son was the result of chance evolutionary design, if he's no more than an animal, if he's just a superior pig, then there's no surprise or shock at finding the prodigal son having his breakfast in the pigsty. The whole point of that story in Luke 15, the whole point of looking with shame and agony at that man in the pigsty is that he came from the Father's house. Isn't that the whole point? If he did not come from there, then it doesn't matter that he's there. And I remember 15, 20 years ago that it always used to startle me when I came into Charing Cross, because there was a paper seller there who was a man who'd been a very senior city executive. And drink had been his problem, and he ended up selling the Evening Standard down at Charing Cross for a few years. Now, you know, it does make a difference, doesn't it, where he comes from? It isn't that I want to be snobbish about being a paper seller. There's nothing wrong in that. But when you've been a senior city executive and you come down to that, why, surely people look on that with a certain pity. Say, why is he there? The Bible looks on man with pity because it knows where he comes from. Furthermore, as the Bible story about the prodigal son makes plain, he is not hemmed into darkness. He's not a prisoner of darkness. He can come back. And Luke 15:2 says that many tax gatherers and sinners were drawing near to Jesus. They were coming back. But despite the wonderful exceptions that we see from time to time, people coming back from darkness into light, the general rule is the tragic one given in verse 19. It remains true that the light has come into the world and men loved darkness rather than light because their deeds were evil. I must hasten now to the application, and I'm going to give only one this morning to this sermon. What is the worst result of man's evil heart? We know that man's human nature is evil and sinful and warped. What's the worst result of it? Well, there are terrible results, aren't there, on every hand. I have been reading this week of the drug trade, and it really is a terrible, terrible story, isn't it? But war, that's really more in our minds this morning. That's a result of the fact that people prefer darkness to light, and it's a terrible, terrible thing, isn't it? Don't let's make light of war. Let's not romanticize it. Perhaps we oughtn't. I gave a child some chocolate sodas yesterday. Perhaps we oughtn't to do that. You know, we oughtn't ever to give the impression that this is a noble and wonderful thing to go fighting with one another. I vividly remember, though I was very small, September the 3rd, 1939, I and my brother and I were tremendously excited, actually, as war was declared, and we stood in the hall at home with our gas masks. Do any of you remember those extraordinary gas masks? Some of you may remember them. They were very odd indeed, and I'm sure they wouldn't have kept us from any gas. And as the Big Ben chimes came at 11, when war was going to be declared that morning, I remember that my brother and I, who were larking about in the hall, were suddenly called to a halt by my father, who looked very solemn, and we were rather frightened. He'd been in the First World War, and he said, "You must remember that war is very terrible." That's one of the terrible results, isn't it, of rejecting Christ. And we're seeing so many of these terrible results today. And how important it is, isn't it, to see from this verse the moral reasons for rejection of Christ, the moral reasons for unbelief, the prevailing myth all this century. When I was at university, when I was at school, the prevailing myth was that modern man can't swallow the truths of Christianity because he's been brought up in a scientific world, he's had a technical education, it would mean intellectual suicide. What nonsense all that is, isn't it? Why does he reject the light? Not because he's clever, or educated, or 20th century man, or Western post-Renaissance man. No, the reason is because his deeds are evil. The fool says there is no God. And the rejection of light means a world full of drugs, full of war, full of all these ghastly things. What are you doing about it? You doing your part? Have you rejected darkness and turned to the light? It's a good thing to ask us this morning. It's hopeless to put the world right unless we put ourselves right first. There's no determinism in John's gospel. We're not fixed where we are today, despite all our habits, despite all that has gone before. We don't have to stay where we are today. We don't have to prefer darkness to light. We can come back. And let's pray that today many people will come back as they see where human folly and evil is taking us without the light of Christ. I'm going to pray, then I'm going to ask you to stand. Lord Jesus, please grant us an understanding of the terrifying results of rejecting the light. Please help us in these 2 minutes to meditate on these things, to remember the past, to make use of it for the present, and to pray for the future. Now let's stand together.